My name's Mark Taylor. I'm the co-director of the Institute of Religion, Culture, and Public Life, which is sponsoring this evening's event, which is the first in our series, which will run throughout the semester, on immigration and incarceration. It's a timely topic, to say the least. We can hope that in a couple hours our president will be addressing some of these issues in the State of the Union address, but I think one of the interesting ways in which this has been put together has been to put these two issues in conversation with each other. We've handed out little cards because the program has two parts to it, a series of, as you see on here, three presentations, but then also a film series that we have, which are coordinated. The films are coordinated with each of these. Will there be discussions at each one of those? So there'll be a discussion after the film that goes with this. And this whole program has been conceived and organized by Laura McDye, Chelsea Eben, and Melissa Vanish. I don't know if she's left or not. They've really done a really, really wonderful job. We're delighted to begin this evening with Alicia Galvez, who is a Columbia graduate, but is now teaching at CUNY. And I'm going to turn it over to Laura, who will do the formal introduction for Alicia and run the discussion today. But thank you all for all the work you put in, and thank you all for coming this evening.
Thank you for that, Mark, and thank you all for coming as well. As Mark said, we are really delighted to be opening this series with a talk from Professor Alicia Galvez. Professor Galvez is a cultural anthropologist whose work focuses on efforts by Mexican immigrants in New York City to achieve the rights of citizenship. As Professor Taylor said, she joined the Department of Latin American and Puerto Rican Studies at City University of New York in fall of 2007 as an assistant professor. She also there directs the CUNY Institute of Mexican Studies. Her first book, which is entitled Guadalupe in New York, Devotion and the Struggle for Citizenship Rights Among Mexican Immigrants, was released in December 2009 on New York University Press. And since then and before, she's published widely on issues ranging from religion to migration, performance, citizenship, reproduction, medical anthropology. Her current book-length project, which is due out soon, is entitled Patients, Citizens, Immigrant Mothers, Mexican Women, Public Prenatal Care, and the Birth of Weight Paradox. So Professor Galvez's talk tonight asks us to consider several questions. How do spaces of devotion become spaces of activism? What role does faith play in the construction of civic spaces and civil society among recent immigrant groups? And what are the limitations of these forms of social mobilization? To help us answer these questions, she will invite us into a decade of Guadalupan-based devotion and activism for immigrant rights amongst recent Mexican immigrants to New York City. Guided by her own extended fieldwork in New York City and many years of activism and advocacy, she will help us think on the challenges of the immigrants' rights movement and its intersections with faith-based institutions and organizations. Without further ado, please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Professor Galvez.
Thank you so much. I want to thank Chelsea for putting this together, and Mark and Laura, and it's a real pleasure to be here, and it feels like sort of a full circle moment to come back to Alma Mater in this capacity. Today what I'm going to do is try to connect what's happening with the immigrant rights movement today to the research that I did for the project Guadalupe in New York. This is something that is a little bit tricky to do because things are changing so quickly, and there's so many moving parts to the immigrant rights movement today. And there's also a decided interest in the immigrant rights movement to really have its members speak for themselves. And so I don't pretend to speak for the members of the movement, particularly the undocumented youth activists, who, you know, obviously do an excellent and far superior job to speaking for themselves than I could ever pretend to do. But I do see some connections between this research and what's happening today. So I will attempt to draw the two together. And really, I think we should begin with a landmark moment, which was May 2010, when four undocumented youth activists occupied Senator John McCain's offices in Phoenix, Arizona, and asked him to support the DREAM Act. This was a watershed moment because even though they had been organizing less visibly for years, the willingness of undocumented youth to literally put themselves on the line for immigration reform was qualitatively different than many past mobilizations. That spring, undocumented youth in Chicago had organized the first national Coming Out of the Shadows Day. And these actions and the slogan, undocumented, unafraid, unapologetic, marked a shift where immigrant youth made the calculated and brave decision that they were safer being out of the shadows than in them. Along with events designed to draw attention to and personalize the impacts of undocumented status and deportation on the lives of so-called dreamers, undocumented youth-led organizations sought to use heightened visibility to protect their constituency from deportation. The power of visibility was seen with some very public cases. One that comes to mind is that of Eric Balderas, the Harvard undergraduate who was taken into ICE custody on a visit to his family in Texas over spring break that same spring, and was freed after the president of Harvard and Senator John Kerry intervened on his behalf. Cases like Balderas demonstrated that shining a spotlight on undocumented youth in custody, celebrating their achievements, their potential, their family ties, and their contributions to the community was an effective way to stop the wheels of the deportation machine. And since that time, there have been dozens of cases, more, that have been handled with, you know, shining that spotlight of public attention onto specific cases in the media, using letters to elected officials, emails, et cetera. And recently, it's important to mention, there's been a concerted effort to provide to use less squeaky clean examples of cases in order to push the thinking on worthiness that has characterized the dream movement. We can talk about that more later. That's not something I'm going to particularly focus on today. Even though Obama's administration exceeded in 4 years the number of deportations over 8 years of President Bush and is on track to hit 2 million in 2014, at the same time, the last few years have seen the undocumented youth movement achieve a visibility, legitimacy, and we could say even trendiness, that's astonishing when examined within the arc of immigrant activism. We've seen events that really contrast with the overall climate towards immigrants of most of the last decade. Tonight, for example, undocumented youth will be featured in the State of the Union address. This comes on the heels of a year of firsts, the Obama administration's announcement last summer of deferred action for childhood arrivals, the showcasing on the second night of the Democratic National Convention at 8 o'clock in the middle of prime time of Benita Vélez, who spoke for several minutes about her experiences and aspirations as an undocumented student. And even the crediting of undocumented youth activism with pushing Obama's campaign closer to issues that matter to Latinos and securing his reelection. These have all placed immigrant activism at the center of the nation's stage in ways that I think are unprecedented. So tonight, I'd like to situate the shifts in immigrant activism within mobilizations by immigrants since around 2000, with special attention to the antecedents to today's immigrant rights movement that I see in some of the activism of Mexican immigrants and Guadalupanos in New York City of a decade ago. While the undocumented youth movement today is very different from movements that preceded it, I think it's actually possible to see some important continuities that are deeper than the explosion of visibility in the last 3 years, especially when looking at the local context of New York City. And the caveat I always have to give is that this is a relatively, the Guadalupan movement in New York City at its peak was a relatively small movement if we compare it to national movements. It also didn't necessarily comprise a majority of Mexicans living in New York City. So, you know, it's something that I think is very important, but isn't necessarily something that You know, we can compare to the scale of the undocumented youth movement of today, which is nationwide. When I began conducting research with Mexicans and Mexican organizations in New York City in 1999-2000, the immigrant rights movement in the city was ascendant. In the mid-90s, New York City had experienced a dramatic influx of migrants from the region of Mexico known as La Mixteca, which are the overlapping states of, it's a region that overlaps the states of Puebla, Guerrero, and Oaxaca. It is possible to attribute the accelerated migration of people from the communities in La Mixteca to a combination of multinational, national, and local economic and political factors, which made earlier modes of subsistence in the region less fruitful at the same time that the flow of migrants to a newer destination was deemed to offer greater economic opportunities, and that reached sufficient mass to enable greater numbers of people to participate. In Mexico, the application of neoliberal policies of structural adjustment, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the devaluation of the peso precipitated an economic crisis in 1994 that had a disproportionately negative impact on poorer and more rural communities. The influx of cheap rice, wheat, and corn from the United States further battered Mexican farmers and the local farm economy. But these events were perhaps only the final straw, given that in 1986 and 1987, a series of events triggered what has been called the migration syndrome in La Mixteca, including a crisis in regional agriculture and increased demographic pressure. Indeed, a greater proportion of people that I interviewed in the course of my study migrated to New York City between 1989 and 1995 than in any other period. Many people that I interviewed in the early 2000s described arriving to New York City in the early 90s and at first worrying primarily about finding a stable housing situation, usually sharing with family members or friends from their community of origin, and work, and they sought to begin to pay off the debts that they had accrued with migration. However, at some point they told me they began to look for more, a place to connect with others, a familiar social context, and to participate in their faith. At the time, 40 Comités Guadalupanos, or Guadalupan Committees, had been formed in Catholic parishes throughout New York City. Some of these were little more than a prayer group. Others were large, multivalent, confraternal organizations with activities that were spiritual, social, and in some cases oriented toward activism. How did such mobilizations by Mexicans in New York churches begin? Were they, as some assume, products of social networks and interconnections among Mexican migrant communities across the United States? The Comités Guadalupanos, an extension of Catholic social organizing in California, Texas, Chicago, and other places? Or were the Comités Guadalupanos a transplant of a form of social organization found in Mexico and carried by migrants to their place of destination? Indeed, in small towns in La Mixteca, the mayordomía system and collective landholding with the ejido, at least until the 1990s, continued to be important forms of organizing social life, and confraternal organizations could, with their centuries of history, be considered a deep structure deployed by rural Mexicans, even while living in New York City. Or were the Comités Guadalupanos a new kind of social organization formed in the context of Mexicans' recent migration to the United States? My interpretation is that the answer is a combination of all of these. Many pastors of churches with active Comités Guadalupanos told me similar stories when describing their realization that Mexicans had arrived to their parish. Father Skelly of St. Cecilia Parish in East Harlem recounted that in 1995, a small group of Mexican parishioners requested that he open the church before dawn in order to celebrate the Las Mañanitas on Guadalupe's feast day. He was surprised but acquiesced, anticipating that the event would be sparsely attended. He was even more shocked, however, when hundreds of people filled the pews at that church on December 12th. The following year, some of the same parishioners requested that an image of Our Lady of Guadalupe be placed in the church. In spite of protestations from Puerto Rican congregants, what the Daily News called the dueling virgins, he agreed, and soon furtive devotees left daily offerings of flowers at the small image's feet. In the ensuing years, the image of Guadalupe migrated forward, ever closer to the altar. Eventually, the coordination of these devotional practices prompted the formation of a committee to accomplish the tasks associated with planning what frequently amounts to an increasingly complex array of devotional practices. In addition to Las Mañanitas, many parishes celebrate the 12th of December with a special evening mass, pray the novena for 9 days preceding the feast, hold a mass for St. Juan Diego on December 10th, a vigil the night of the 11th, and hold a party featuring a dramatic reenactment of the apparition, folkloric dances, a talent show, food, and a sonidero, which is a kind of DJ light show. While many parishes began only by organizing Las Marianitas on the morning of the 12th, the coordination of such a celebration requires a great deal of social capital, money, social networks, and organizational skills. The efforts to honor Our Lady of Guadalupe in a suitable fashion on her feast day are what prompted the formation of a Comité Guadalupano in many parishes. And this is the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is outside St. John Parish in Mott Haven in the Bronx. Father John Kenny, pastor of St. John Church in Mott Haven, began to notice Mexicans arriving to his parish around 1990. They were not yet a continuous presence at Mass, nor were they becoming involved in the church's organization. But he began to find flowers left at the feet of the image of the Virgin of Guadalupe and noticed that on the 12th of December, Mexicans turned out on Mass. Inside the sanctuary, he told me, the church had always displayed a framed painting of the Virgin of Guadalupe, the ubiquitous reproduction of the image as it appears on the Basilica at Tepeyac. And even though he didn't remember who had placed the image there, a lot of the members of this church named that image as being what had drawn them to the church. Many churches, in fact, that were among the first to celebrate the 12th of December and form Guadalupan groups in the early 90s did already housed an image of La Guadalupana. And so it seems no accident that people were drawn to these churches, often choosing to travel to them rather than attend their local parish where they did not notice the same visual signifiers of welcome. My book is about how New York-based Mexican immigrants envision community, develop modalities of collective organization, reimagine their own identities, and turn these to the task of broadening their rights, all in the idiom of devotion to the Virgin of Guadalupe. All of this was happening in parish-based confraternal social organizations, the Comités Guadalupanos, which together are linked in a network called Asociación Tepeyac de New York. Members of these organizations joined together as immigrants, and in defiance of the undocumented status many of them shared. As such, they developed a mode of being, of situating oneself with respect to the state and the society in the U.S. and in the broader multinational globalized sphere that neither assumed assimilation nor the seamless maintenance of ties to the homeland. Instead, it was an activist enfranchised identity, as globalized as the capitalist economic forces which prompted their migration in the first place. Uniquely dedicated to the transformation of life in the present, not in the nostalgic past of home, quote unquote, nor in the imagined future of return or legalization in the United States. This transformation, I think, has implications for notions of citizenship. While much writing on immigration assumes that citizenship is a condition that begins after the bestowal of juridical attributes of belonging, I argue that Mexican immigrants were engaging in political activist activities which enhanced their sense of well-being in material, lived, and symbolic ways, even while their juridical status remained unchanged. And I think surprisingly to us all, remains unchanged to this day, because it certainly felt in the early 2000s that immigration reform was inevitable and would be soon in coming. This kind of citizenship, broader, more performative, and more agential than the strictly juridical classification of citizens, was necessary, I argue, to all other rights projects, both in the realm of formal citizenship as well as in other areas of social life. Mexican immigrants' involvement in such activities, and perhaps more importantly, the disposition which enabled such engagement, is not easily measured quantitatively in votes cast, dollars raised, petitions signed, or meetings attended. Such dispositions may not register on formal surveys of political activities, but it's no less important and real for the people involved. Indeed, it was their engagement and willingness to stand up for themselves and other members of their community, that they created, that may have had the biggest impact on their quality of life in the United States. Legalization of their immigration status, if and when it came, would be joyfully welcomed, but they no longer held their breath. It's likely that many of today's youth activists were raised on the kind of humanistic Catholic rights discourse prevalent in the Comités Guadalupanos, sitting as children in pews of churches and on the folding chairs of church basements, listening to particular messages about the inherent dignity of the migrant and the need to assert one's rights against those who would deny them basic human dignity. The height of the Comités Guadalupanos in New York City just preceded the explosion of broad-based immigrant activism in 2005 and 2006. And I think it's important to contextualize some of the history of immigration reform and activism in the last quarter century. So just to give you just a brief bullet list, this is a lot of information, but 1986 was the last time that we had an immigration reform that actually helped immigrants. It's commonly referred to as the amnesty. It was signed by President Reagan, and it allowed people who had been here prior to 1982 to achieve residence and eventual naturalization. It also instituted employer sanctions for the hiring of undocumented immigrants. And at the time, it was thought that bipartisan immigration reform could only be achieved with carrots and sticks. And we'll see as the list goes on that we lose the carrots and we keep the sticks. So since the law did little to adjust the availability of visas for future immigrants or to allow the country to expand or contract its openness to immigrants with economic conditions, it's widely viewed as having failed to address future immigrant flows. Most immigration policies proposed or revised in the intervening years were focused on punitive enforcement and border security. So in 1996, we get IRA-IRA signed by President Clinton, which many restrictionists view as addressing what they called the magnets that drew immigrants to the U.S., our generous health care and other public benefits. IRA-IRA barred even permanent residents from accessing publicly funded welfare or Medicaid benefits for the first 5 years after their changing of status. It also reclassified, importantly, as deportable offenses under immigration law, a whole host of crimes, that including some that are only misdemeanors under civil code. And so it initiated the massive flow of deportations that's only continued and increased in recent years. Importantly, it also removed judicial discretion, making it impossible for judges to consider the impact of a deportation on the U.S. citizen or permanent resident family members left behind. And in fact, it seems only just last month that the new Morton memo that Obama issued is the first time that sort of judicial discretion has been brought back into the picture since 1996. Concurrent with all of this was an explosion of spending on the militarization of the border. So we see from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s a rise in the undocumented population reaching 12 million, but at the same time that we see record deaths on the border and the cumulative effects of long-term undocumented status on the cognitive, social, psychological, and academic achievements of the children of immigrants. Then we also see just some other moments. We see H.R. 4437, which would have criminalized undocumented presence as well as humanitarian assistance to undocumented immigrants, which sparked the big protests in 2006. This was passed in the House, failed in the Senate. This was the Senate's version, which was pushed very hard by McCain and Kennedy, but passed the Senate, failed the House. This one would have been a little bit more of a carrot and stick than this, which was all stick. Just as an aside, even though the DREAM Act was actually put up 10 times over since 2001, several times in 2001, several times in other years, all the way up until December 2010, which was the last time it most spectacularly failed. But it was actually often strategically shelved by the immigrant rights movement in favor of a larger comprehensive reform because it was thought that it was too easy. Its beneficiaries too compelling and squeaky clean, and that if it sailed, as it sailed through Congress, it would leave efforts to achieve larger reforms devastated in its wake. So obviously the climate has changed quite a lot now, and in the last couple of years that the DREAM Act has been pushed again by immigration reform movements themselves. As purported federal unwillingness or inability to address immigration continued, the same period that we're referring to was characterized by a trickle of legislative efforts at local, municipal, and state levels to address pieces of the immigration puzzle in ways that sometimes were much more cruel and sometimes much more generous than anything proposed at the federal level. So, for example, while the city of New Haven, Connecticut proposed a local ID which would enable those residing in the city to conduct all their local government business, irrespective of immigration status, the town of Hazleton, Pennsylvania made it illegal to rent a home or business to someone who's undocumented. obviously the biggest moment here in terms of activism was here in the spring of 2006 when we see the largest mobilizations of immigrants in U.S. history. And this was a real turning point in which 500,000 people took to the streets in Dallas, Texas, 1 million in Los Angeles, 500,000 in New York City, and all over the country we see huge numbers. The Comités Guadalupanos, the umbrella group linking them to Tepeyac, and larger groups of immigrant groups were central to these to local mobilizations in New York City and were involved in large-scale coalitions of immigrant rights movements. Momentum at the local and national level seemed at the time sufficient to force legislative action, but eventually the grand bargain in Washington would fall apart before achieving concrete results. But it's quite arguable that those marches set the stage for everything that's happened since. They produced a visibility that I think had not been there prior to that. At the time, activists who were undocumented struggled with whether to expose themselves in the national media or in local news media. While the director of Tepeyac would say, quote, no one was ever deported because their name appeared in the newspaper, members of the Comités Guadalupanos were familiar enough with deportation and its everyday palpable risk to know that people were deported for much less on a regular basis. At the time, messaging within the immigrant movement emphasized strength in numbers. Individual stories were rarely told. The message was one of generic humanism. These are mothers and fathers who are doing what anyone would do to provide for their child. These are self-sacrificing, hardworking, and devoted contributors to our economy, workers, families, and they deserve human dignity and respect. The strength in numbers approach enabled members of these organizations who often did not consider themselves to be activists to feel comfortable taking to the streets without fear of being singled out. Only those who chose to do so interacted with the media or took on roles as spokespeople. This approach is starkly different from that of today's undocumented activists, but I think it did set the stage. Within the national context of immigration reform, religious movements played a powerful role. It's difficult to consider now that with everything we've heard recently in the media about figures like Cardinal Roger Mahoney, the Archbishop of Los Angeles, that in fact he and others were highly visible and influential in their efforts to voice an argument for immigrant rights premised on Catholic humanism. And Claudia's work is a beautiful description of a lot of these movements in Los Angeles. For example, in 2003, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and the Episcopado Mexicano issued a joint statement entitled Strangers No Longer, Together on a Journey of Hope, that articulated the right of migrants to seek the basic necessities of life, even when that entailed crossing a border. Arguing that national sovereignty, while a value, was of secondary importance to the value of human life. Many voices within the Catholic Church, as well as other religious institutions and Christian denominations, were vocal in their assertion of immigrant rights and the basic human dignity of migrants. In the early 2000s, the Comités Guadalupanos organized within very specific frames and ways that are very prescient of the shape that later mobilizations would take. They utilized Catholic humanist discourse to articulate the basic rights and equality of human beings as children of God. And these discourses enabled the comités to assert that their activism was not political, but was about human dignity. So here we see, you know, one example of this. Loving mother, please alleviate our exhausted steps. Protect us with legalization. Within the comité, I think I have a quote. So this is a quote from the Strangers No Longer Together on a Journey of Hope. Our dialogue has revealed a common desire for a more orderly system that accommodates the reality of migration and promotes the just application of civil law. We invite Catholics and persons of goodwill in both nations to exercise their faith and use their resources and gifts to truly welcome a stranger among us. Within the Comités Guadalupanos, a collective ethos emerged that was organized around what I call three vectors of identity: Mexican national origin, Guadalupan devotion, and undocumented immigration status. While not every member of the Comités Guadalupanos subscribed to all three of these vectors of identity, they discursively served as the common denominators, uniting the members of the most active groups. While many of the comités were formed with the purpose of organizing devotional practices to Our Lady of Guadalupe, posited as a common Mexican experience, any wider discussion of the issues faced by the group's members usually circled back to immigration status. So I want to give you some more ethnography and just to briefly describe, I focus in the book on three major moments of activity of the Comités Guadalupanos. One is micro-local, called the La Misión, or the Mission, or the it has several different names, where they carry an image of Guadalupe very locally on foot from house to house. The Via Crucis, which is the performance of the Stations of the Cross that happens in parishes but also happens in Wall Street, the Via Crucis del Inmigrante, the immigrants Stations of the Cross. And then the Antorcha Guadalupana, which is a torch run where a live flame is carried from the Basilica of Guadalupe in Mexico City overland by relay runners to New York City, to St. Patrick's Cathedral. So I want to share a little vignette from a discussion about the Misión Guadalupana. Alberto, who is the president of the Comité Guadalupano of one of the Bronx parishes, says, here we have a Misión Guadalupana. We carry the Virgin with her message every 8 days, all year long. Doña Lisette said, she's around here on Jerome Avenue, but not many people are coming to the mission, and I hope people start to come more. That's what brought us all together here. The Misión is not doing well. There are few people, and we wait sometimes until 9 o'clock and people don't arrive. Very few people, not even 10 people. It's not working. For our little mother, because she opened the path for us, everything we have today is because of her, and I'm afraid the day we have it all, we're going to forget her completely. Without us, she can't walk. She has her Alberto, who, again, is the president, says she has her stand, her vases, her box, and she needs at least 8 people so that she is not alone. And altogether, the collection box and the statue and everything were actually quite heavy, so there was often discussion of how many people were needed just to physically lift her. Someone else said, well, that's not a lot compared to all she does for us. And this Don Omar is the founder of this comité, and he said, I have a proposal. What if we form groups, but you, the board, have to do it. One of you has to participate each time. And just to contextualize, he was the founder of the comité, but no longer was an office holder. And so he was constantly sort of mentoring the office holders, particularly Alberto, who was extremely young and would never have had that kind of position of power traditionally in a mayordomía situation back in Mexico, but had ascended through hard work and lack of other people who wanted to take on a leadership role much more quickly than would have been expected. And so Don Omar is constantly trying to coach him into how he should do these things. As board members, you have to take the information to the people, the amnesty bill, the information about bank accounts, etc. Even if people don't come to the comité, they need to be informed. Put me down. Let's see, who will come with me? Who supports me? Don Roberto, will you help me? Of course. Very good. So in this vignette, we see the ways that, you know, an older leader of the community rallies support for something that that the whole group acknowledges is one of the most important things that they do, and in fact a very small thing that's being asked of them, right? Every 8 days, every week, to go and walk a few blocks in the community. And I like this because he really situates the way that the comité envisions the activist work to be embedded into the devotional practice. It's the way of getting the message out there. The members of Los Comités Guadalupanos frequently insisted that their main purpose was simply to pay homage to their mother, Our Lady of Guadalupe, who they often repeat, as they do here, that she has done so much for them. The political activist work of the comités was folded into this purpose, a means of redeeming the Virgin's children from exploitation and oppression, always in her name. I never observed that the comités concealed the political content of their work. However, they frequently struggled with what they perceived as the difficulty of recruiting new members if they tried to do so on an explicitly activist platform. If joining a religious organization is negatively viewed by some migrants, recent migrants in particular, political organizations can be object of even greater stigma. Not only did many people view political organizations, especially parties and unions in Mexico, as corrupt and in some cases complicit with creating the social and economic conditions which led them to emigrate, they often sense that in their new context as undocumented immigrants, to be associated with organized labor or political parties was to invite trouble from their employers, or worse, attract the attention of border enforcement authorities. Recent migrants in particular told me that they preferred to evitar broncas, stay out of trouble and avoid unwanted attention. For this reason, comité leaders frequently remarked that if they simply knocked on people's doors and began to talk about amnesty, which was the catch-all term used for immigration reform, during that period before it got kind of taken out of the lexicon, that they would have little luck. In an interview, Alberto, the president of the comité, told me that with the image of the Virgin, the group's members can go door to door, taking in information and inviting people to participate, that in fact she's the only way that people will open the door and hear them out. In this way, the Misión, while one of the least spectacular activities of the comités, was justifiably referred to by some members of the groups as the most important. The profile of Tepeyac, the umbrella organization of the comités, reached its peak with the campaign undertaken following September 11th. They were the first organization to really actively seek to address the needs of the unknown victims of 9/11, the workers who were not on the books, the widows and children of those who hadn't been working under their real names, who would never receive packages for survivors. As well as those who had been displaced from jobs in the area surrounding the World Trade Center. Rather than call attention to individual stories, efforts to build solidarity around the struggle for immigration reform in this period utilized allegorical accounts of, quote, the immigrant experience, often linking them to other historical struggles, such as the Calvary of the Cross and Exodus. In this press, in particular in the Via Crucis procession, the traditional script describing Christ's path is overlaid with a new script, comparing his travails at each of the stations of the cross to the humiliations and injustices suffered by immigrants. And so I want to show you a little bit of the stations of the cross of the immigrant, which is in occurs annually in the area around Wall Street. So this is an example, the second station. Jesus carries a cross he does not deserve and suffers what he needs not suffer. We do not deserve to emigrate, to leave our land and our people. Nonetheless, we have to work to support ourselves and support our family for lack of possibilities in our own land. And as they walked, they drew real blood through the tunic of the person who was performing as Jesus. And they evoked comparisons between the Romans and the U.S. Border Patrol agents by shouting, camina, camina ilegal, walk, walk, illegal. When they did the procession in their home parishes, they said, camina, camina, ladrón, walk, walk, thief. But they changed it to ilegal when they were doing it in Wall Street. The semantic charge of the text and closeness between the script's focus on the exploitation faced by immigrants and the crucifixion of Christ were clearly deeply felt. This was not simply an event designed to make Christians contemplate the sacrifices that the martyr had made for them, but a performance of the ways that this population felt the pain Christ experienced in their own lives and on their own bodies. Those who walked performatively equated Christ's persecution with the structural economic forces that pushed them from their homes and drove them to New York City. El Via Crucis del Inmigrante is offered in memory of those migrants who have fallen in the struggle to survive with greater dignity outside of their land, far from their families. And the document that's printed for the participants by Tepeyac, and which includes the script for each station, represented a theological defense for migration. It argues that immigrants should be treated with the human dignity that their status as God's children affords them. In four introductory pages, the document quoted the United States Council of Catholic Bishops and Mexican Episcopates jointly authored document again. That says, you know, our dialogue has revealed the same one that I quoted before. Calling for a just application of civil law. And then the reflection at the end of this document sets the tone for the Via Crucis. It says, our Christian faith makes us think that the Via Crucis, or way of the cross, is not just similar to the paths of millions of immigrants and refugees in the rich countries. The path of suffering of immigrants and refugees is the same path walked by Jesus. The stations of the cross made clear an equation between the suffering of Jesus and that of immigrants through examples. In the first station, Christ is condemned to death, and in front of 26 Federal Plaza, which is where one goes if one has immigration paperwork to do, which is a privilege that most people who are undocumented don't actually have, but they know that's where they would have to go. Jesus spent his, the station that's in front of 26 Federal Plaza says, Jesus spent his life working and doing right. Even though he was innocent, he was condemned to death by Pilate. This was followed by a section entitled Testimony, which described the case of a young couple who whose child was born with health problems, and they condemned the inattention of the hospital where they went to seek care to their child's health problems, resulting in the child's death. The second station similarly condemned the separation of families by immigration law. I think that's the one that, let's see, Jesus falls, oh, no, it's not, third station. Jesus falls from the weight of loneliness and the lack of support from those who come from the same town, the same social class oppressed by the Roman Empire and the upper social class at that time. We, the immigrants, are all part of the same immigrant people, part of the ethnic minorities, and we are the ones who are almost always discriminated against. Nonetheless, in moments of confusion or difficulty, we abandon our own people. Communities can be, and this was contextualized in terms of a condemnation of gang violence and domestic violence in the communities that were being described. Communities can be entities that are self-designated, but more frequently they are ascribed by outsiders for whom the internal differences of a group are less visible than the external signs of perceived commonality. Communities are also imagined in contradistinction to those who are different. By living in neighborhoods scattered throughout New York City and originating from many different places in Mexico, Mexican immigrants in New York City are not a community based on propinquity in their origin or in their current settlement patterns. In fact, Mexicans can be found in all five boroughs and every zip code. The Comités Guadalupanos and Asociación Tepeyac promote the feeling, akin to Díaz-Barriga's structures of belonging among their members, that they belong to a single community which is defined in contrast to those who are not Guadalupano, Mexican, or undocumented. As such, performances of belonging and of exclusion, like the Misión Guadalupana and the various Via Crucis, serve to delineate who we are for the various members of local and citywide groupings of Mexican immigrants. So I want to show you a little bit of the, this is a poster for the torch run, again, that goes from the Basilica of Guadalupe, and then it actually heads south to the Mexican immigrant, the communities of origin of many Mexican immigrants who live in New York City, and then they go up the eastern seaboard of Mexico and through the southeast and up past the White House, arriving at St. Patrick's Cathedral in time for December 12th, feast day. These are images of the arrival of the Antorcha, the first time it was binational. It's actually 2002 as it arrives in New York City. You can see the torch there. And then I want to just contrast a little bit the images of the Via Crucis of the Immigrante, and then these are some of the images of the undocumented youth movement, like the walk to Albany last spring, where undocumented youth activists walked 150 miles to Albany to ask the legislature and Cuomo to consider the New York State Dream Act. Coming out of the shadows, undocumented, unafraid, unapologetic. And then again, this is 2003. This is in the Via Crucis of the immigrant. No human being is illegal. Amnesty. And we see the same sorts of messages. There was one somewhere that said, no human being is illegal. There was one other thing I wanted to show you. So these are images of the three students, one of them a Columbia student. And to CUNY, she's at Lehman College, she's Columbia, all Mexican origin, raised for the most part in New York City, and they were arrested outside of Cuomo's office on Fifth Avenue, I believe, last spring, and they, you know, had to go to court, and eventually they were able to plea, I think, just to disorderly conduct, and were allowed to go without penalty. I think it's hard not to see the parallels in the message, the motive, as well as the performative style of some of these different moments in the immigrant rights movement. So I think that ethnographic research with undocumented youth activists would reveal more about the motivations and influences of this group, but I think it's clear that the activism of their parents' generation, while comparatively timid compared to getting arrested deliberately, was in its context very radical and brave, and articulated particular arguments for rights that have continued to have valence into the present day. So thank you very much.
So we're excited to be able to open up now for questions, comments, and conversations.
Are these blocks that you say, like the walk to Albany, are mm-hmm. they just Mexicans? I mean, are there multiple?
No, they aren't. But, I mean, nationwide, the immigrant rights, the immigrant population is about 60% Mexican. And obviously it varies regionally with areas of much higher percentages. In New York City, Mexicans are a very small percentage of the immigrant population, but a large percentage of the immigrant rights movement. So they don't overwhelm, but I just found it interesting that all three of these young women who, there were three people arrested that day, and all three were young Mexican women. So I don't want to say more than, you know, I don't want to infer too much out of that. I just think it's a very interesting coincidence. Yes?
Sounds like you're primarily arguing that the use of religious imagery is primarily directed inward to the community, mm-hmm. to resonate within the community, but is it being used at all strategically to resonate outside, you know, like the religion maybe is this thing that people identify with? Or?
The message was focused differently depending on the activity and the moment. I mean, there was definitely a viewpoint that religious imagery would be more effective with the outside world than political imagery. And there, you know, and you see even, there was a protest, I should have put this in the slides, there was a protest that I went to in 1999. There was, I don't know if any of you remember, but there was a couple of day laborers who were beaten almost to death in Long Island. And there was a protest in Union Square. And that was the first time I recall seeing Our Lady of Guadalupe at a protest. And there was just a sign, you know, just an image with no letters or anything. It was, she was just sort of a silent participant in the protest. And so there's, I think, a sense that it's sort of inviolate, and there's very strong connections to how she's viewed in Mexico. In Mexico, there's a sense that she's above politics, and anytime politicians actually try to, like, I remember when Vicente Fox was running for president in 2000, and he went to the Basilica of Guadalupe, and he thought that, you know, he thought the worst he'd be accused of was pandering. And in fact, people were extremely offended that there would be any connections made between, you know, kind of mundane politics and something so holy as Our Lady of Guadalupe. And so there's a sense that she's, you know, the patroness of the Americas. Everyone can respect her. She's not a political figure. At the same time, that there are messages that are definitely internal. So the Via Crucis del Inmigrante, there at the time was no translation of the Stations of the Cross. I translated the Stations, but the document that the participants were using had no translation. There was nobody in charge of kind of telling passersby what was going on. And my analysis ended up being that was purposeful, because then you turn the passersby leaving their office buildings at 5 o'clock on Good Friday into kind of the seething masses of unfeeling, citizens watching Jesus go to the crucifixion. And so it heightens it for people to be, you know, bustling by in a unfeeling or maybe even hostile way.
Hi.
So I don't think it's as you heard what the timeline is now.
Yeah.
What your sense is, you know, as it's in the Bay Act, just actually lost its space.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of the sort of Mexican movements that were popular in the 2000s, you know, seem to be less prominent.
Yeah.
The YLC, the Vision Project, the Locked Alamy is fairly secular, and things are much more secular than they were to me.
Yes.
I'm curious what your sense is about why, and even new Mexican groups like Buenos Aires is starting, mm-hmm. is actually as a preventive service agency and a business agency. So I was wondering what your sense is about why Mexican immigrant organizing in New York over the last decade seems to have become more secular, and their messaging and everything seems to be much less theological.
Yeah. I think it's a lot of different factors. I think actually September 11th helped Tepeyac and also maybe resulted in its eventual demise. It's hardly in existence anymore. They have a new space, and I hope no one's here who is deeply offended by that assessment, but it's a shadow of what it once was. And I think there's actually a chapter that I wrote that addresses that issue specifically, really looking at how the influx of resources kind of obliged it to grow into an agency in ways that it wasn't really coherent with what they had been doing before, and it wasn't a growth that was measured or kind of reasonably paced at the time. And just, they were flooded with resources because they were doing an amazing job after September 11th. But it was in such the ways that the resources came in didn't enable them to grow their capacity in a sustainable long-term fashion. And so I remember the year that their annual report had no images of Guadalupe, and they had like a butterfly because the funders wanted them to address Latinos, not Mexicans, and be more secular. And so they were really obliged to become more of an agency instead of many of the members of the community that had been involved since its founding. This was, you know, it, 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 it was dead to them at that point, you know, if they couldn't feature Guadalupe on their cover. There are organizations that still, I think, see Guadalupanismo as being one of the most powerful ways of reaching people and finding, articulating certain kinds of messages with people, certainly the Archdiocese and a lot of the stuff that they're doing, as well as, you know, organizations that are secular but still, you know, have other ways of operating, like Mano a Mano, Mexican Culture Without Borders. But yeah, it's a very different moment. It's a very different moment. And the, you know, the leadership in the church is different. Some of the priests, you know, one of the most active priests, you know, kind of had a run-in with Egan and was basically removed from his parish, from one of these two parishes. So there's been a lot of water under the bridge, and a lot of it has been very unfortunate, because there was a peak moment where there was a lot that was happening. But the youth, you know, the YLC, you know, they're taking it in a different direction, and I think there's still a lot of really interesting stuff happening. But it almost the moment it was published, I thought, wow, this could never be, you know, no one could do this project, you know, even when it came out in 2009, it was already a document of a moment that was passing.
Two quick questions. One, I'm curious as to towards the organization of the La Antorcha Guadalupana movement, mm-hmm. because it's bilateral in yeah. the U.S. and Mexico. Like in Mexico, who's organizing it?
Yeah.
Is it their home communities, like the networks they still own uh-huh. in La Mixteca, or is it like NGOs? Like, I don't know, how does that transit happen? And also, I'm curious as to what the response with the Catholic non-Latino community in New York has been towards the Guadalupe movement. Like, has it remained isolated, or have they been sort of mm-hmm. welcomed in by sort of like the WASPy
right.
Catholic community?
Right. Yeah, a couple of big questions. In Mexico, it's all of the above. It's NGOs. It's, you know, there was a very activist priest in Puebla that was, you know, really central to the early years of mobilizing. You know, it's a lot of groups. I mean, as you probably know, La Antorcha is such a it's such a important kind of almost rite of passage for a lot of young people to go to the Basilica of Guadalupe in the weeks preceding December 12th. And so it's sort of something like, oh, we're doing an antorcha. Oh, okay. Whereas here it's like, we're doing an antorcha. What? You know, how? Over land? Really? You know, just the premise of, you know, carrying this thing on foot these long distances was sort of mind-boggling on the U.S. side of the border, but on the Mexican side was not seen as being something so difficult. In fact, the Basilica told me that they weren't involved and wouldn't be. They were involved in the sense of making the facilities available, but they would not promote it because they told me, you know, if we don't promote it, 10,000 people show up. If we say anything publicly, we're going to get a million people here, and we don't want to deal with that. So, you know, they were sort of low-key about it in terms of their involvement with it. In terms of WASP, my colleague Judy Hellman, who wrote a great book, a couple of great books about Mexican migration, said, you know, everyone, she has a great way of describing it, which I'm not going to do justice to, but how the people that she interviewed living in New York who were from Mexico said that, you know, as they were coming to New York City, you know, they all expected this sort of John Wayne, icy blue eyes, you know, white guy as their, you know, boss/landlord, you know, kind of this image of the gringo that they were going to have to deal with. And in fact, none of them ever encountered any gringo who was like that, or even any gringos at all, because most of them are living in communities where their bosses and their landlords are other immigrants. And so the oftentimes who they're interacting with is not WASPs, certainly not in the Bronx in these communities. And they do have serious kind of dynamics that happen in terms of other groups within their churches. For example, one of the churches, the Comité Guadalupano, had a very hard time interacting with some of the Dominican and Puerto Rican parishioners. And a lot of these parishes, in fact, before Mexicans arrived in the mid-90s, had seen a dwindling of you know, their congregations, and some of them, you know, had only a few little, you know, Puerto Rican and Dominican abuelitas who would come to Mass. And so the church acknowledges that Mexicans, with their young families and their tendency to stay Catholic, unlike many other groups, have been kind of the saving grace of the church in terms of numbers. And some of these parishes were slated for closure right up until, you know, the kind of the peak of when Mexicans started to arrive. And now, you know, they have very healthy congregations. And so there are tensions, but it's usually not with WASPs. And I'm not even sure that they're registering sort of on a citywide basis in terms of, you know, groups that people are seeing.
I wonder if you can comment on how other markers of identity may have played and may have interacted with each other in these dynamics. I mean, in gender, age, race.
Yeah, it's variable even within the comités. One of the comités that I worked with closely had all female leadership. The other one had all male leadership. You know, I can't really generalize in terms of that, but there are lots of, and one of them had older people who were sort of in charge of the comité, and the other one had younger people who ran the show. So. And there's a lot of, one thing that is important to acknowledge, there's a lot of, obviously, inequalities within the Mexican immigrant community, and so indigenous Mexican immigrants often are marginalized within organizations. But I did see that there a lot of indigenous Mexican immigrants played a special role in the Comités Guadalupanos because, and some of this is based on stereotypes, there's an assumption and association of indigenous Mexicans with flowers. Historically, over the last 20 years, one of the niche labor markets for indigenous Mexicans was working in the flower arranging, the little delis that have flowers outside all over the city. A lot of them are mixtecos, and flowers are the most important devotional offering to Our Lady of Guadalupe. And so mixtecos were seen as playing, in many cases, a very unique and important role in terms of devotion to Guadalupe, but I didn't see mixtecos taking leadership roles in the comités.
So. You mentioned in passing the idea that some of the undocumented student activists today might have grown up in these communities and hosted these activities. I'm curious if and I know, your current research isn't necessarily on this, but I'm curious if even anecdotally you've come across that.
Yeah, I mean, they do, they participate. I know several students, I advise the Lehman Dream Team, and several of the students involved with that are in folkloric dances at churches that have Comités Guadalupanos and participate in the feast day. I have yet to really map it and see if it's the comités that have been the most active in the immigrant rights movement. I would like to do that, but I haven't done that.
One of the things that we're hoping to do through this whole series is bring together conversations around immigration and incarceration. And I'm thinking back to some of the tensions even around 2006 between the kind of illegal versus criminal and butting up against of immigrant rights and prisoner rights movements. And what you presented to us here, I think, helps us think in really productive ways about the complex intersection of criminal justice and immigration, detention or deportation, and the lives of people that you've worked alongside and field work with. So I would just love to invite hearing a little bit more about, more than even the stories you shared with us, either from the kind of sticks more or the dream team.
Yeah, I mean, that's been one of the messages that's been constant, is the pushback against the criminalization of undocumented immigrants. And so we can see, like, in the other slide of the young woman. you know, no human being is illegal. I mean, this was very strong messaging from about 1999, 2000, in terms of, you know, really pushing back against the criminalization of communities. And the way that that was done with the Comités Guadalupanos in the mid-2000s was really more about, we come here to contribute. And there was a lot of, you know, what I kind of call the sweat equity argument for citizenship rights. We contribute, therefore we deserve citizenship rights. And I've actually critiqued that a little bit because I think it leaves out huge quantity. You know, what if you don't work? What if you're a stay-at-home mom? What if, you know, what other way, you know, are you thus less of a citizen, less contributing? How do we give value to other kinds of work and labor that are accomplished and contributions that are accomplished outside of the economic realm? Because a lot of it really was centered around, there was such a, you know, fusing in some moments, especially in 2006, I think, of the labor rights movement and the immigrant rights movement, which was novel because, you know, couple years before that, the labor unions actually didn't really want to have that much to do with the immigrant rights movement. But when that happened, there was even more of an emphasis on this idea of work, and that's very problematic. I mean, a lot of people have done a lot of work on this. So I think I think that's an important thing, is to look at, you know, where are the arguments being situated in terms of where do the rights come from, right? And one of the things about, you know, this movement is that rights come from God. So laws, you know, laws are petty and, you know, made by mundane and made by human beings who are, you know, innately fallible. And so, you know, human beings can be wrong. The laws can be wrong. We can change them. God's law is of a higher moral authority. So I think that's a very powerful thing. Obviously, you know, it has limitations in terms of secular immigrant rights movements, but I think it gave sort of an underpinning to this idea of, you know, sort of humanist notions of human dignity, which I think are very, very prevalent. And so, you know, now there's, you know, the undocumented youth movement has really pushed the discourse, you know, to back towards amnesty. You know, as it kind of has gotten clear that the DREAM Act could pass, it's like, well, no, what about our parents? And what about, you know, our brothers who maybe have a conviction for, you know, truancy or graffiti from when they were 12 years old? Will they be left out? And so there's a lot of talk about, you know, inclusiveness and again, human dignity, and not, you know, chipping away, not making it just the squeaky clean, you know, staple the green card to the PhD, you know, or the engineering diploma, but, you know, what is owed to the larger concept of family and you know, immigrant communities.
Still thinking about this earlier question about the a generational shift from religious to not religious.
Yeah.
And there's certainly a lot in play, but I'm also thinking about your comment about Mahoney and the sort of last 10 years for public Catholicism.
Yeah.
In terms of not lay groups, but in fact an institutional structure that's a certain, a different kind of public base, even certainly in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you have more, if you've thought more about this particular power, perhaps of a certain kind of public Catholicism that's been able to do or use, have some kind of political effect in a broader scale. And so how, I mean, I wonder also how much, I'm sorry, you know, how much of this, some of these public events are not just calling on a public, but actually also calling on a Catholic leadership to pay attention. So if you have any more you would add.
Well, Marion Ronan was supposed to come tonight, and I would have just deferred to her. But it's very sad. It makes me very sad, actually, to look back at, you know, what was happening in the mid-2000s and what's happening today, because I think there's a serious vacuum in terms of moral leadership on this issue. I think there's been a real power to when the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops was so vocally in favor of immigration rights, and when the activists in L.A. knew that Mahoney not only had their backs, but was, you know, really openly, publicly, you know, making, you know, statements to the world media on this issue. And there was just really no doubt about the leadership of the church on this issue nationally and in New York City. And I think that that's, you know, it's really silent right now. I mean, the the decimation of leadership, you know, for various reasons, mostly unrelated to the big scandals, it's sad. It seems like a waste. I mean, I know that the Archdiocese right now in New York City is planning to kind of gear up for a really big kind of effort to reach out to the Mexican community and serve the Mexican community in the coming year or two, which is great. But it feels, I think, to a lot of activists that it's a little too late. There's been, you know, a lot of alienation that's happened in the last couple of years. I remember when I was at a conference a couple of years ago, and Ana Diaz told me that, or actually her husband, Steven Arroyo, told me that Ana had been at a lunch with Cardinal before even O'Connor. Yeah. Yeah. Had been at a lunch, and he said, you know, we lost the Puerto Ricans. We intend not to lose the Mexicans. I thought that was gold, but he, you know, there was apparently a great consciousness of how important it was going to be to serve the Mexican community. And I think that was really lost. I mean, there was stuff with Tepeyac, where Tepeyac, I think, lost a little bit of legitimacy in the church's eyes, but the church also lost legitimacy in Tepeyac's eyes. And, you know, there was a lot of sort of dynamics that happened that meant that a lot of potential was lost. I think that there could be a huge role. And I don't hear the church speaking up, you know, whenever you hear the church mentioned in the media in relation to national politics right now, it's about, you know, affordable care and birth control. It's not about immigration reform. And so it's a shame. Yeah.
As well, what is the role of any evangelical churches? Maybe not the Mexican community, but other
I mean, in 2006, I actually don't know what's happening right now, but in 2006, there were, you know, the Baptist Convention, you know, issued a very public statement in favor of immigration reform. There's been a lot, you know, they've definitely not been against immigration reform, and in fact, in many cases, have been very publicly for it.
The Catholic Church's contraction on this issue creates space for evangelicals to assert leadership and
Yeah.
Policy.
Yeah.
I'm curious if that was happening.
Yeah. Well, oh, and I'm sorry, and just one more thing. The Lutheran Church has been really big in the sanctuary movement, and so, you know, giving refuge to people like Elvira Arellano within the church, trying to push, you know, the whole idea of new sanctuary. That's been another area of leadership.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes.
You have human dream team events, you have people that are simultaneously missionaries wanting to pursue Catholic goals,
yeah.
as you have very out
lesbian, yeah.
gay, and queer identified
yep.
Members. I'm just curious whether you see any friction. I mean, it never seems to emerge.
Yeah.
Or it has. I mean, there are points of friction, but is that potentially one explanation for change?
I think it absolutely is. Out of the four students that occupied McCain's office in Phoenix in 2010 and really launched the undocumented youth movement, three are out as undocu-queers. And in the YLC, it's a majority of the executive committee is out as undocu-queer. So I think that's definitely an explanation for some of the push more towards secular forms of mobilization. And I think it's, you know, really productive, you know, kind of in terms of thinking about articulations of, you know, visibility, invisibility, rights. And, you know, there's a lot of really productive things that are happening that are probably filling some of the mental space that was maybe taken up by more of the Catholic humanist stuff with the parents' generation.
Maybe a comment that will link it back to your interest or the interest of the series on criminalization and incarceration. I think that while the mass movement that happened in the 2006 with the marches was particularly, did bring a lot of visibility that led to some of the mobilization mm-hmm. that we saw afterwards in pro-immigrant rights struggles, it also brought about a very cruel backlash against the immigrant, undocumented, or unauthorized community. And the system of deportation centers and exploitation within those deportation centers and the deportations per se grew tremendously and really peaked after that, so much so that now Obama has had more deportations in 4 years than the 8 years of Bush and all of that, those sort of things. So that really, really put a halt into a lot of the groups and the individuals' commitments to this. These movements and devotional practices all together, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Thank you. I don't know what else. Thank you very much. This was really interesting. Thanks for the good questions and comments. It's going to happen tomorrow. I don't know. I mean, if you'd asked me to bet in 2005, I would have said it's coming any day, but you know, I don't know. I think it has to come. It has to come soon. The question is, I think, what the ratio of carrot to stick is going to be. I think the good news is that the discourse has been pushed much further back into the realm of reason than it has been in the last 7 years, or 6 years. So that's good. That's really good. But it's still a long way from where it was in the early 2000s, where it was really all the talk was just about amnesty and how liberal will the amnesty be? And now it's a question of, will there be a path to citizenship? And even deportations haven't been really, call me a kind of stubborn idealist, optimist, but I've always thought that Obama was allowing the deportation level to get as high as it was to really kind of force a conversation, and so that people would actually see what the current state of the policy environment produces and demand a shift, because if a shift had been demanded, like with so many of his efforts, he's still being accused of doing nothing to enforce the border and doing nothing to enforce the existing laws, when in fact the opposite is true. But I don't know. No crystal ball.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank
for
you.
Incredible
thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks. You did a great job.
Aww. It's hard to connect the new stuff with the old stuff.
No, but I think it opened that up. Some of the most interesting questions came alive, precisely from that tension, thinking about what all of the various shifting forces that are so common in the basement, where are they now and how to hold those in.
Yeah. Sorry.